Hey everyone, welcome to another deep dive. And today we're going exploring some really cool archaeological discoveries that have the potential to totally change how we see the Old Testament.
It's going to be like we're traveling back in time.
Yeah, kind of. We're going to be looking at all sorts of stuff from ancient inscriptions to entire cities. And we'll be asking some big questions along the way.
Do these discoveries actually prove the Bible, or do they maybe paint like a more complicated picture?
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes the complexities can be even more, illuminating than a simple confirmation or whatever.
For sure.
Okay, so our first stop is this place called Kuntalet Ajrud. It's like in the Negev Desert, like a really arid area.
Imagine like an ancient rest stop, at a crossroads, all these travelers and merchants coming and going in camels,
Yeah, totally. Not where you'd expect to find a theological controversy.
Right. But that's exactly what happened. Archaeologists found these huge jars called pithoi, and they were covered in inscriptions invoking blessings and stuff. But get this, they said, Yahweh of Samaria and his Asherah.
Whoa, okay, hold up. Yahweh, that's the God of Israel. But Asherah, isn't that like a Canaanite goddess?
Exactly. And finding them together like that really threw scholars for a loop.
Yeah, that definitely complicates our understanding of, monotheism in ancient Israel.
Right. Was the worship of Yahweh always exclusive, or was there a period where different religious ideas were all mixed
It's
together?
kind of like a mind-blowing concept, right?
Totally. And the debate really hinges on what Asherah means in this context. Are we talking about the goddess herself, or a symbol that represents her, or even just a weird grammar thing from the ancient
So it was
language?
a linguistic puzzle with some pretty big implications.
Exactly. It challenges us to think differently about how monotheism developed. Maybe it wasn't this sudden change, but a slower, more gradual process.
That makes a lot of sense when you think about how religion and culture kind of evolve over time.
For sure.
All right, so let's move on to a different site now called Kitef Hinnom. It's an Iron Age burial site near Jerusalem.
This discovery is all about these tiny silver scrolls amulets. They were found super carefully during an excavation.
I'm picturing archaeologists sifting through dirt with tweezers.
Pretty much. And when they finally deciphered the inscription, guess what it was?
I don't know, what was it?
The priestly blessing, word for word, from number 6.2426.
Whoa, okay, that's got to be significant.
It is. It's the oldest known written example of a biblical text.
Wow. So these tiny scrolls could change how we think about when key parts of the Bible were written down.
Yeah, exactly. And it challenges the idea that the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, were written much later than we thought.
That's super interesting. It also makes you wonder, what did it mean for the people back then to wear these amulets? Were they hoping for protection, or was it more like a statement of faith?
It's hard to know for sure, but it's definitely something to think about.
Okay, so get ready for a change of scenery now. We're going to Mount Ebal in the West Bank. They found a massive stone structure there that has caused a ton of debate.
This structure dates back to the Iron Age, which is right around when the Israelites were thought to have settled in the land. And some scholars think it's the altar built by Joshua, from the Bible.
Whoa, wait, really an altar from the time of Joshua? That's wild. What's the evidence for that?
Well, first of all, the location is right. It's on Mount Ebal, exactly where the Bible says Joshua built an altar.
Okay, that's one point.
And then there's the animal bones. Excavations found a huge number of them, all from kosher animals, and they all showed signs of being burned in a sacrifice.
Starting to sound pretty convincing.
Plus, the structure itself has a ramp and a surrounding wall, which matches descriptions of ancient Israelite altars.
So it's in the right place, has the right kind of animal remains, and looks the way it's supposed to.
Yeah.
It does kind of seem like textbook Israelite altar.
It does. But archaeology doesn't really offer proof in the absolute sense.
Right, it's more about evidence and interpretation.
Exactly. But it does give us this amazing glimpse into a world where altars and sacrifices were central to people's religious lives.
Yeah, it's really incredible to think that we can connect these physical remains to the stories in the Bible. But okay, let me ask you this. If this is Joshua's altar, does that mean the early Israelites were as unified and powerful as the Bible sometimes makes it seem?
That's where the debate gets really interesting. Some scholars say, yes, this discovery supports a more literal reading of the Bible. But others point out that the evidence could be interpreted in different ways. Maybe this altar was more of a local or tribal thing rather than evidence of a huge unified kingdom.
So even with something like this, something that seems pretty straightforward, there's still room for debate.
Absolutely. And that's what makes this whole field so fascinating. It's a constant process of discovery and interpretation and reevaluation.
Yeah, it's like this never-ending puzzle. Okay, next up, we're going to the Judean Desert to explore one of the most significant archaeological discoveries ever, the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Oh yeah, the Dead Sea Scrolls. These scrolls are a treasure trove of ancient manuscripts representing almost every book of the Hebrew Bible, plus a bunch of other Jewish writings. They give us this amazing look into the world of Second Temple Judaism.
I remember learning about this in school. It's like a major discovery, right?
Totally. Imagine this Bedouin shepherds looking for a lost goat stumble upon a cave, and inside are all these scrolls. Talk about a lucky break.
Wow, that's a crazy story.
Yeah.
So what kind of secrets did these scrolls reveal?
Well, for one thing, they provided much earlier copies of biblical texts than scholars had ever seen before.
So before that, our understanding of the Bible was based on copies that were like centuries removed from the originals.
Exactly. And what's really cool is that the Dead Sea Scrolls show us that there were variations in the text. Different readings, different arrangements of books, even different wording sometimes. It shows us that the process of copying and transmitting these texts wasn't perfect. It was a dynamic process with changes happening along the way.
So it's not like there was one official version of the Bible back then, but a bunch of different textual traditions all influencing each other.
Exactly. And that's a huge insight. It means the Bible we have today is the result of a long and complicated process. It's a reminder that the Bible wasn't just dictated from on high, but that human hands were involved in writing, copying, and interpreting these texts.
It's amazing how these scrolls, hidden away for centuries, have changed our understanding of the Bible. They've shown us the text is not set in stone, but has evolved over time with different communities and scribes contributing to its development.
That's right. And they also shed light on the diversity of beliefs and practices within Judaism at the time.
Yeah, it was a period of a lot of change and upheaval, right?
Exactly. Different Jewish groups were struggling with their identity, their relationship with Rome, and their hopes for the future. The Dead Sea Scrolls give us a glimpse into all of that.
So the Dead Sea Scrolls aren't just about ancient Judaism. They also help us understand the world in which Christianity emerged.
Exactly. They help us grasp the religious and social climate of the first century. It was a world full of debate, new ideas, and different expectations about the Messiah.
It's like we're tracing the roots of Christianity back to this really vibrant and diverse Jewish world.
That's a great way to put it. Okay, let's step outside the world of ancient Israel for a bit and head north to the city of Ugarit on the Syrian coast. Have you ever heard of Ugarit?
Yeah, I think so. Wasn't it a Canaanite city?
You got it. Archaeologists found a huge archive of clay tablets there, inscribed with texts in a language called Ugaritic.
Canaanites, that's a name we hear a lot in the Bible.
Yeah.
But I don't really know much about their culture or anything.
Yeah. Well, these Ugaritic texts are a goldmine of information about them. We learn about their gods, their myths, their literature, even like practical stuff like how to treat a sick horse.
That's pretty cool. A horse medicine recipe from thousands of years ago.
Right. But what's really fascinating is how these texts help us understand the cultural context of the Bible. Remember, the Israelites didn't live in a vacuum. They were surrounded by and influenced by their Canaanite neighbors.
So by learning about the Canaanites, we can better understand the world the Bible was written in.
Exactly. And one of the most interesting things is the similarity between Ugaritic poetry and biblical poetry. They both use this thing called parallelism, where ideas are repeated and developed in successive lines.
Huh. So even though the Bible often portrays the Canaanites as enemies, it seems they shared some cultural and literary connections.
Totally. It's a reminder that cultures are rarely isolated. They influence and shape each other in all sorts of ways.
This is blowing my mind. Okay, one last stop before we wrap up this part of our deep dive. Kirbet Kayafa. This is a site overlooking the Elah Valley, the same valley where the story of David and Goliath takes place. What's so special about this site?
Kirbet Kayafa is a fortified city from the early Iron Age Tusect, which is the time period associated with the rise of the Israelite kingdom, and its discovery has sparked a ton of debate because some scholars think it was a city from the time of King David.
Oh yeah, I remember reading about this. The existence of a powerful united monarchy under David and Solomon is already a pretty controversial topic among scholars.
You got it. So the stakes are pretty high with this site. What does the evidence tell us?
Yeah, what does it tell us?
Well, the city has two gates, a large central complex and defensive structures, which all point to a level of organization and centralized authority that's pretty advanced for this time period.
That does sound like it could fit the description of a city in a powerful kingdom.
Right. But here's the catch. Dating archaeological sites is really tricky, and there's some debate about the exact date of Kirbet Kayafa. Some say it's from David's time, while others think it could be earlier or even later.
So the dating is crucial for figuring out its connection to the Davidic kingdom. What other clues do we have?
There's that inscription on the ostracon. Remember that little piece of pottery with writing on it?
Oh, yeah. The one that could be Hebrew, but also might be Phoenician? That seems like a pretty important detail.
It is. If it's Hebrew, it would be one of the earliest examples of written Hebrew and could support the idea of a more developed Israelite state during David's reign.
But if it's Phoenician, then it suggests a different set of cultural and political ties.
Exactly. That little piece of pottery could hold the key to understanding Kerbet Kayafa's place in history.
It's amazing how such a small object can have such huge implications for our understanding of the past.
That's archaeology for you. It's all about discovery, interpretation, and reevaluation. Even a tiny inscription on a broken piece of pottery can change how we view history.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
It's like holding a piece of the past in your hands, connecting with people who lived thousands of years ago.
That's the beauty of it. It brings the past to life in a way that nothing else can. We can walk in the footsteps of ancient people and try to understand their world.
That's what makes this deep dive so amazing. It's not just about learning facts, but about connecting with the past and exploring the forces that shape the world we live in today.
I totally agree. And this is just the beginning. We've only scratched the surface of this incredible field. There's so much more to explore, so many more mysteries to unravel.
And that's exactly what we're going to do in part two of our deep dive. Welcome back to our archaeological adventure. I'm still kind of blown away by all the stuff we talked about in part one, you know, like how these actual physical pieces of the past can make the Bible feel so much more real.
Yeah, it really brings it to life, doesn't it? Like, it's one thing to read about ancient cities and rituals and stuff, but it's totally different to actually see the ruins and, like, hold a piece of pottery from that time. It makes you realize these were real people living real lives, you know?
Totally.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes I get a little lost in all the academic debates around these discoveries. You know, like, are archaeologists actually trying to prove the Bible, or are they trying to, like, debunk it? I'm not always sure what they're going for.
Yeah, that's a question that comes up a lot. And it can get pretty intense. There are these terms like maximalists and minimalists that get thrown around, which can make things even more confusing.
Okay, so break it down for me. What are maximalists and minimalists?
Basically, it's like a spectrum. On one end, you have the maximalists, who tend to see archaeology as basically confirming the Bible's historical accuracy. You know, they're looking for evidence that supports the biblical narrative. Then on the other end, you have the minimalists, who are way more skeptical. They might see the Bible mainly as a theological or literary work and not necessarily a historical one.
So it's like a battle between the Bible is always right and take the Bible with a grain of salt.
That's a pretty simplified way to put it. But yeah, it kind of captures the tension. The truth is both approaches can be problematic if you take them too far. Like, you can't just ignore evidence that doesn't fit your view or just assume the Bible is a perfect historical record. It's more complicated than that.
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess archaeologists are like everyone else. They bring their own perspectives and assumptions to their work.
Exactly. And the Bible itself isn't simple either. It's a collection of texts written and compiled over centuries by different people with different perspectives and goals and writing styles.
So how do we navigate this whole thing? Is there a way to approach archaeology and the Bible without getting stuck in those ideological battles?
I think the key is to move beyond that simple dichotomy of proving or disproving and try to find a more nuanced approach. Instead of trying to force everything to align perfectly or just dismissing any connection, let's focus on how these two things can inform each other, you know, how they can both contribute to a better understanding.
I like that. It's not about winning or losing, but about learning and getting a fuller picture. So how does that actually work in practice?
Let's go back to Kerbet Kayafa, that city we talked about. Remember all the debate about whether it was from King David's time?
Yeah, the one with the two gates and that inscription, that might be Hebrew.
Right. Instead of getting bogged down in who's right or wrong, let's just look at what the evidence tells us about that time period. We have a fortified city with a pretty complex layout, which suggests a level of social organization that's pretty impressive for the early Iron Age.
So even if we can't say for sure if it was from David's time, it still tells us something important about how Israelite society was developing.
Exactly. And the fact that the stuff they found there, the pottery, the architecture, it's more similar to what we see in Judah than in Philistine sites. That's significant, too.
So it suggests a cultural connection with the area that would later become Judah.
Right. And that's valuable information, whether or not it proves anything about King David.
Uh-huh. I'm starting to see how this nuanced approach works. It's about looking at all the evidence and being open to different interpretations.
For sure. Okay, now let's go back to those Kuntalet Adrud inscriptions with Yahweh and his Asherah. That was pretty wild.
Yeah, totally. It really makes you question what monotheism actually looked like back then. Was it as clear-cut as we tend to think, or was it more like a blending of different beliefs?
Those inscriptions and other discoveries seem to suggest that the development of monotheism in ancient Israel was a gradual thing. It wasn't like a light switch flipping on.
It's like they say, nothing is ever as simple as it seems.
Right. And it's important to remember that ancient Israel wasn't isolated. They were interacting with all these other cultures and religions around them.
So maybe these inscriptions show a time when different religious ideas and practices were coexisting and maybe even mixing together.
That's one way to look at it. It shows us that religious beliefs and practices are always evolving. They change over time based on all sorts of social, cultural, and historical factors.
It's fascinating how archaeology can challenge our simple ideas about the past and show us that things were actually much more complex.
Absolutely. Okay, now let's have a quick language lesson. Remember those Ugaritic texts we talked about?
Oh, yeah, the ones from that Canaanite city Ugarit.
Those tablets are amazing. Not only do they tell us about Canaanite culture, but they also help us understand how ancient languages and writing systems evolved.
Okay, you've got my attention. Tell me more.
Well, the Ugaritic language is like a cousin of Hebrew. So by studying Ugaritic grammar and vocabulary, we can understand the nuances of biblical Hebrew even better. It's like having a cheat sheet for the Bible.
Wow, that's cool. So it helps us decode the Bible in a way.
Exactly. And the similarities between Ugaritic poetry and biblical poetry are incredible. They both use this technique called parallelism, where they repeat and develop ideas in successive lines.
So even though the Israelites and Canaanites were often enemies, they still share this literary connection.
Right. It shows us that these ancient cultures weren't just isolated islands. They were constantly sharing ideas and influencing each other.
It's like we're seeing this whole web of connections across different cultures and languages.
Exactly. Okay, now let's go back to archaeology for a minute. What about that massive stone structure on Mount Ebal, the one that might be Joshua's altar?
Oh, yeah, the one with all the animal bones. It's crazy to think that something so big could survive from that time.
I know, right? Whether or not it's actually Joshua's altar, it still gives us valuable information about how people worshipped back then.
What do you mean?
Well, the fact that it's such a large central altar and that they found all those animal bones there, it suggests a pretty high level of organization. You know, it wasn't just random individuals doing their own thing. There was some kind of communal religious activity going on.
So it shows us how ancient Israelites practiced their religion, how they expressed their faith through rituals and sacrifices.
And this is where archaeology and the Bible really complement each other. The Bible gives us the stories, the laws, and the theology behind these practices. And archaeology gives us a visual. It helps us see how those things played out in real life.
It's like watching a movie adaptation of the Bible. It helps us connect with the story on a deeper level.
Great analogy. Okay, speaking of connecting with the story, let's talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls again.
The Dead Sea Scrolls. I am still amazed that those fragile scrolls managed to survive for so long, hidden away in those caves.
It's pretty incredible, right? And the Dead Sea Scrolls are important not only for the sheer number of texts they contain, but also for the variety.
You mentioned multiple Judaisms before. Is that what you were talking about?
Yeah. The Dead Sea Scrolls show us that there wasn't just one type of Judaism back then. There was a whole spectrum of beliefs and practices within Judaism.
So it wasn't like a monolithic religion with everyone believing the same thing.
Not at all. The community that created the Dead Sea Scrolls, for example, had some unique views on certain theological and legal issues. They had their own interpretations of scripture, their own rituals, and even their own expectations for the Messiah.
So it was a really dynamic and diverse religious landscape.
Exactly. And it's important to remember this diversity when we're trying to understand the historical context of Jesus's life and ministry.
Whoa. So the Dead Sea Scrolls don't just illuminate ancient Judaism. They also help us understand the New Testament.
You got it. They give us this amazing backdrop for understanding the religious and social ferment of the first century. There are all these different ideas about the Messiah, different interpretations of scripture and different approaches to religious law all swirling around.
It's like we're tracing the origins of Christianity back to this vibrant and diverse Jewish world.
That's a great way to think about it. Okay, before we finish up this part, let's go back to those tiny silver scrolls from Ketuvot Hinnom, the ones with the priestly blessing.
Oh, yeah. Those are some of the earliest examples of biblical text ever found.
They really challenged some of the older theories about when parts of the Bible were written down.
It's not just about what the Bible says, but also about how it came together. How did these ancient stories and laws get passed down, written down, and eventually compiled into the book we have today?
That's a great question. And archaeology can help us trace that evolution. It can shed light on the process of how the Bible was written, transmitted, and eventually canonized.
It's like archaeology is giving us a behind-the-scenes look at how the Bible was made.
Exactly. And that human element is something to keep in mind. It reminds us that the Bible isn't just some abstract divine revelation. It's a product of human history, culture, and interpretation.
Right. It's both divine and human. It's a complex book with a long and fascinating journey.
Well said. And our journey of discovery isn't over. There's still so much to explore, so many mysteries to uncover, and so many insights to gain as we keep digging into this amazing intersection of archaeology and the Bible.
Wow. I'm telling you, I am still processing everything we've learned about in these last two parts. It's just amazing how archaeology can make these ancient stories and cultures, you know, like, come alive.
It's true. It really does. Like, we've been on this incredible journey through time, you know, walking through the ruins of ancient cities and, like, trying to decipher these cryptic inscriptions. It's incredible.
It really is mind-blowing. And honestly, it's changed how I see the Bible, you know?
Yeah.
It's not just a book anymore. It's like this window into this whole world full of life and conflict and drama and everything.
Yeah, totally. Speaking of drama, let's talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls again. We touched on how important they are for understanding the diversity of ancient Judaism, but they also have these huge implications for, like, the history of the Bible itself, you know, like how the text has changed over time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fill me in on that. What can these scrolls tell us about how the Bible's journey through time?
Well, before they found the Dead Sea Scrolls, our understanding of the Hebrew Bible was mostly based on medieval manuscripts, which are valuable, of course, but they were like centuries removed from the originals.
So it's like trying to understand Shakespeare by reading a copy that's been like passed down and copied and recopied for generations.
Yeah.
You know, like each scribe might have added their own little twist to it.
Exactly. But then the Dead Sea Scrolls show up and they're from the Second Temple period. So they give us a much earlier glimpse of these biblical texts.
It's like finding Shakespeare's original handwritten manuscript with all the notes and crossouts and stuff.
Right. And what they found was variations, you know, different readings, different arrangements of the books, even different words in some cases. It totally changes our understanding of how the Bible was copied and passed down. It wasn't this perfect error-free process. It was much more dynamic and fluid.
So it's like there wasn't one official Bible back then, but a bunch of different versions kind of like floating around and influencing each other.
Exactly. It's a really important insight. It means the Bible we have today is the result of this long and complicated process of like transmission and interpretation and, you know, editorial choices being made along the way.
It's kind of humbling when you think about it. It means the Bible isn't just this divine revelation that dropped out of the sky, but it was shaped by human history and culture and, you know, all the interpretations along the way.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. And honestly, it doesn't take away from the Bible's authority or significance. I think it actually makes it more interesting and more meaningful.
Yeah, I agree. It adds another layer of depth to it. Okay, let's change gears for a minute and talk about writing systems. Remember that mysterious inscription from Kirbek Kayafa? The one that might be Hebrew, but might also be Phoenician.
Oh, yeah. That was a tricky one.
It's crazy how one little piece of pottery can cause so much debate among scholars. But it brings up this fascinating question about writing systems in the ancient Near East. You know, like how did different cultures influence each other's writing?
That's a great question. The ancient Near East was like this melting pot of cultures, and that included their writing systems. Mm-hmm. The Phoenician alphabet, for example, was used all over the place for trade and communication, and it had a huge impact on other alphabets like Hebrew.
So it was like a family tree of alphabets with all these different branches and connections.
Exactly. And that ostracon from Kirbek Kayafa, whether it's Hebrew or Phoenician, gives us this tiny glimpse into that world of ancient writing and all the cultural exchange that was happening.
It's a good reminder that even something as basic as an alphabet isn't static. You know, it's constantly evolving and being shaped by these interactions between different cultures.
Totally. And that idea of interconnectedness is something we keep seeing throughout our exploration, from the religious mixing at Kuntalea Druid to the shared poetry styles between Ugarit and the Bible. It's clear that these cultures were constantly in contact with each other, sharing ideas and practices and even their writing systems.
It's like this vast network of cultural connections spanning across ancient cities and trade routes and religions.
Exactly. It reminds us that the world of the Bible wasn't this isolated bubble. It was part of this much larger and more complex cultural landscape in the ancient Near East.
Okay, so big picture question here. After all this amazing stuff we've learned about, what do you think is the most important takeaway for our listeners?
That's a good one. I think the key takeaway is that archaeology can help us understand the Bible in a much deeper way. It can give us real, tangible evidence for the world the Bible was written in. It's not about trying to prove or disprove the Bible, but about shedding light on the historical and cultural context.
Yeah, it's about seeing the Bible not just as a book of stories, but as a window into this vibrant and complex ancient world, a world that was shaped by all these different influences and innovations.
Exactly. It's an invitation to engage with the Bible in a more nuanced and informed way, appreciating its history, its cultural influences, and its power to speak to us across thousands of years.
So beautifully said. And to our listeners, thank you so much for joining us on this incredible journey through time and discovery. We hope you've enjoyed exploring these amazing archaeological sites and learning how they can shed new light on the Bible.
Mm.
Keep exploring, keep questioning, and most importantly, keep that curiosity alive. You never know what amazing discoveries are waiting to be uncovered.